Mr. Stewart, I'm putting you on. You can brief us. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Chair. And welcome, everyone, and thank you for this opportunity. So I realize we have very little time. I will just briefly introduce the team. So at the far end is Chris Atkinson, who's the Chief Director for Economic Tax Analysis. Next to him is Deborah Makwiramiti, who works in the Fiscal Policy Unit. And then it's Duncan Peterson, the Acting Head of Economic Policy Division, and myself, Ian Stewart, Acting Head of the Budget Office. And that's the team I will be presenting today. Again, just to say, you know, thank you to all the contributors. We went through your submissions in detail. We've tried to lift out the overarching elements of each presentation, and in general, we found across a wide range of inputs that, in broad terms, this is what was discussed. The first is, I think, broad questions around the fiscal policy stance. And for us, it was very interesting to note just how wide the opinions are around the current fiscal policy stance. There's certainly disagreement around whether we're spending too little or too much. Talk of austerity on the one hand, and of course concerns on the other hand that in fact we have raised the expenditure ceiling. And I think all of this talks to the difficulty of the fiscal situation we find ourselves in, that difficult decisions have to be taken, and that's what is reflected in this budget. And we are well aware that every decision that we take has consequences, both good and bad, but ultimately we have to balance these different objectives, and that's what is presented to you in the budget 2019. There was a lot of talk about the tax mix, and Chris particularly will go into that, what is good for growth and progressivity. Many concerns about the level of taxation, but here again, there's difference of opinion. We had some input suggesting that in fact we can raise taxes, particularly on high income earners, discussions of a wealth tax, for example. On the other hand, many inputs suggesting that we reached what you call the top of the Laffer curve, in other words, a point at which beyond increases in tax actually reduce, lead to declining rates of collection. And in fact, also a few commenters noting that we have a declining tax to GDP ratio, which is also a major concern for the Treasury. So I think that was the broad first area. The second was around the growth and revenue forecast and the credibility of the medium-term numbers. We've put together some slides that talk about where Treasury's forecasts sit relative to other credible institutions, and our view remains that our forecasts are in line with what we're seeing going on globally and amongst the credible domestic institutions that forecast both growth and revenue, which doesn't mean to say we're not well aware of the risks around these numbers, and we've got specific growth scenarios, which Duncan will also talk to, and certainly we've made this point repeatedly. There are many risks around the numbers in this book, many risks around the spending numbers, specifically around state-owned companies and Eskom, risks around tax collection and the rebuilding process at SARS, and risks around other line items, including the wage bill, and we're very clear about that in the book, and certainly we can discuss that as well today. And then the second point around that is, are our tax buoyancies too optimistic? And we're going to talk a little bit about that, specifically about the numbers for next year, which came up repeatedly in a range of different presentations. Thirdly, there were a lot of specific tax matters. So the first two, I think, are very broad about where we are, where the budget deficit is, what our debt numbers look like, what our stance is in general terms. Then we moved on to specific matters. Carbon tax implementation came up, fuel levy and its impact on paraffin, biofuels. Clarity on the VAT refund figures was requested, and another comment about the policy of retrospective amendments and what that means for the tax laws that we introduce. And again, Chris will be talking to that. I think Chris is going to have the busiest day of the four of us this morning. And then the last was some specific budget matters. Yes. Very happy to be the one, no doubt. Then the last was specific budget matters. And here it's more, again, about information sharing. There were some questions about the early retirement intervention and implications for service delivery support for Eskom. Of course, a long discussion on the proposal to double the December old age grant, and another proposal around the subsidization of insurance premiums for emerging farmers. And those we will touch on at the end, but they are discussed in the book. So that's quite a long introduction, but I think that covers the inputs we received. And I think I'll just start, before I hand over to Duncan, who will talk about the forecasts, and then to Chris about the tax-specific tax issues. Just want to make a few general comments about where we are and how the logic of the budget was brought together in the Budget 2019 book. The fundamental issue that we're struggling with, we've maintained this for a while, is that the economy is not growing at the rate it should be. And in fact, the story of the past few years, as you can see from since the 2009-10 recession, is that the economy bounced back to around 3% growth, and then since then it's been declining pretty consistently. And as you can see, once again, we are projecting an improvement over the medium term, that's the dotted line, but we've also noted that there are a lot of risks around these numbers, and in particular what we're seeing is that the global outlook is becoming less supportive for emerging markets. So, you know, if we were concerned before about the general global and domestic outlook, it's also the case that at the moment China and Europe are revising down their growth rate. These are our major trading partners. And, of course, uncertainty is increasing with Brexit and the trade tensions between the U.S. and China. So, in fact, the global environment of the past few years has actually been more supportive of emerging markets than what we're likely to see over the next 3 years. And Duncan is going to talk a little bit about that three-year forecast just now. But that really is at the heart of the issue, because the story of the past 6 years, or 7 years, since the introduction of the expenditure ceiling has been one of maintaining the expenditure ceiling and revising it down consistently. This budget is the first one since the introduction of the ceiling where we've actually revised up the ceiling, and the vast majority of that increase relates to support to ESCOM. So in general, it's been a story of maintaining expenditure ceilings and declining revenue and economic growth, which has led to a persistent widening of the deficit. And in addition to that, we've seen a lot of pressure coming through from the wage bill and the wage agreements that have been signed over the past decade. And the result is that we continue to keep borrowing when obviously one of the key goals of fiscal policy is to narrow the primary deficit to the point that we can stabilize our debt to GDP ratio. I've included this graph just to give a sense to the members of what has been going on since over the past decade. I think it's quite a striking graph in the sense that it shows the split between the primary deficit and the interest payment that we are currently paying on our national debt. Okay, I'll slow down a bit. Okay. Apologies, I know we seem to have a time limit, but I will do my best to slow down. What this graph is trying to show is that over time, the share of the budget deficit that's attributed to our debt service payments has gone up over time. And effectively, you know, we're projecting a deficit of around 4.3% in the outer year of the medium-term framework, and the majority of that is going to be interest payments. And for me, that's one of the major arguments as to why you want to stabilize and bring down debt over time, because otherwise your debt interest payments continue to grow as a share of your total deficit. The other issue that came up again repeatedly was the topic of the gross tax revenue. And this graph simply shows, which is a concern for us, that the tax to GDP ratio has actually declined since around 2015-16. And that between budget 2018 and budget 2019, for the current fiscal year, we've revised down our revenue estimates by 42.8 billion, which is very substantial. And this shortfall has actually been increasing over the past 3 to 4 years. And it's reflected here that our tax to GDP ratio has actually flattened and started to come down despite the fact that we've introduced significant tax increases. And we think that's a combination of the economic slowdown and the administrative weaknesses in SARS. So you can already see how the budget is having to manage both declining GDP growth, declining tax buoyancies, and a variety of expenditure pressures. And what we have in this graph, again, perhaps for the speed at which we're going through, this is a lot of information, but what this graph is effectively showing is that our largest state-owned companies have debt redemptions of around 40 billion rand next year and 55 billion rand in the year thereafter. And the issue is, like Eskom, there are other SOCs that are struggling to meet their debt obligations. Their return on equity has been declining. And what we show in the budget review is that if you take out their capital investment figures and their debt servicing figures, most of these institutions have negative cash flows. And that's discussed in quite a lot of detail in Chapter 8. So at a time when the economy is slowing, where tax revenue is declining as a share of GDP, we also have these significant pressures coming from the state-owned company sector, and the budget had to balance all of these at the same time. So this graph we show every year, I think it's important for two reasons. The first is that it gives you a very good sense of what the fiscal policy story has been over the past decade or so. The red line on this graph is non-interest expenditure of main government. And the interesting story here is that the mid-2000s was a period of a large expansion of the size of government. So you can see that main budget non-interest expenditure increased from around 22% of GDP in 2005 to around 27% of GDP in 2009-10. That, of course, was that spike also included the 2009-10 recession. And since then, non-interest spending has basically been flat as a share of GDP since 2009-10, and in effect, the expenditure ceiling has just meant that spending remains unchanged broadly as a share of GDP, while on the other hand, main budget revenue has been creeping up over time as we increase taxes and as the economy recovered somewhat from the recession. And what we're trying to achieve, to simplify the story greatly, is to get those two lines to cross, because once they cross, which was the case in the mid-2000s, then you start to run primary surpluses, and when you run primary surpluses, your debt-to-GDP ratio stabilizes and starts to come down over time. So that summarizes a lot of fiscal policy theory and the history of the budget, but the fundamentals are you need to run primary surpluses if you want to stabilize and bring down debt, and I've tried to explain why continuing to increase the debt-to-GDP ratio is not good for our spending patterns or for the economy. This is a summary of effectively what happened in the budget. I know most of you are probably quite familiar with this, but I thought I'd summarize it again in the simplest possible fashion. What we've done effectively on the spending side is introduce baseline reductions of 50 billion over 3 years, of which a substantial share, let's say just over half, relates to slowdowns in compensation growth over the next 3 years. And then, of course, these reductions have been offset by allocations of about 75 billion. And of that amount, 69 billion is for Eskom over the next 3 years. We've also raised the contingency reserve in the current year because we are well aware that other smaller state-owned companies, including Denel, SAA, and the SABC, are likely to require some kind of financial support, but we have put some conditions on that. The one is that non-core assets of an equivalent amount are sold, and we know that DPE is working on a series of reforms for these institutions that will look at, amongst other things, strategic equity partners. So we are, in effect, raising the contingency reserve to signal that we know there are going to be pressures coming from the SOC sector beyond just Eskom. The tax measures, again, there wasn't a lot of, I think there was a bit of confusion around this immediately after the budget, but tax measures amount to 15 billion next year, and the majority of that is giving very limited fiscal drag relief. And the other elements are inflation-related increases in the fuel levy and, of course, the introduction of a new carbon tax, which was also a topic of discussion and Chris will touch on. So that sums up, in broad terms, what happened to the fiscal framework. We reduced baselines We had to increase aggregate expenditure overall because we had to reallocate a large amount of money towards ESCOM. We put in some additional funding because we know there are big risks coming from the smaller state-owned companies, and we've increased taxes by 15 billion in 2019-20, and we've penciled in a further 10 billion the year thereafter. How exactly that will play out will depend on many factors, including how quickly the SARS reform process supports tax collections over the next 2 to 3 years. There was quite a few comments about, are we too lax or are we being too austere on the spending side? I just wanted to include this graph, which is one we've shown many times in the past, but the point of it is to show that since the introduction of the spending ceiling in around 2012, spending growth did decline substantially from what we'd seen in the mid-2000s. But our view is that this is not austerity, this is continued real expenditure growth over the medium term. And if you look at where the fastest growing areas of expenditure are, well, unfortunately, at the top of the list is debt service costs, because our debt-to-GDP ratio continues to grow. So our fastest-growing area of spending are our interest repayments on national debt. And again, this is a good reason as to why you want to stabilize and bring down debt over the longer term. But if you take out your debt service costs and look at your non-interest spending, we're looking at above-inflation growth for community development, learning and culture, social development, and health. And those at the bottom that have receiving the lowest growth rates are general public services, which includes the Treasury and peace and security. So in general, the budget has tried as far as possible to balance a lot of competing objectives while providing real expenditure growth to the key social expenditures. And if you want to look at it in terms of the structure of the budget rather than the growth rates, you can see that learning and culture over the next 3 years gets 1.2 trillion rand, followed by social development, of which gets approximately 900 billion, and health, which gets approximately 720 billion. And of course, the social development number, the vast majority of that is social grants. Okay, so that gives us the headline figures, and I know I've had to rush through it, but I hope that gives you a sense of the kind of trade-offs that have to be taken into account. Broadly speaking, we have to decide whether we're going to allow the expenditure ceiling to be increased or not, and our sense was that we've done significant expenditure cuts on baselines over the next 3 years, but that once one takes into account the impact of ESCOM, we had to allow debt to GDP to rise somewhat, and then we were going to balance that off against some spending reductions and, of course, increases in taxation. And hence the slight worsening of the deficit. Yeah, so if you think about...
Honourable members, make your notes about what you want to engage on, and we take the questions at the end.
Okay.
Can you speak a bit just slower?
Okay.
Put a few speed bumps in between.
Okay, yeah. I'm aware that we've got...
Relatively new, can I just explain to you?
Yes.
All of us here, even the peasants in Mongolia that watch this program, know that Tandi is extremely slow.
Okay.
And she's not bright, as we associate. And, oh, she would say she's stupid. Now, we all know that, right? That's why we love her so much.
Okay.
And then we start at her level, okay? You have to learn that, because Tandi is not a person in this committee, right? We have 9 members and 1 phenomenon. And none of us can manage this phenomenon.
Sure, that's
true. Order. Order.
Let me say that again, because I'm about to hand over to my colleagues on the forecasting discussion. But just to repeat again, I mean, the fundamentals were that we had to make decisions in an environment in which GDP growth is slowing, in which the tax to GDP ratio is coming down, and in which we're seeing major expenditure pressures coming through, specifically from the state-owned companies. And of course, ESCOM dwarfs the others in terms of the size of the requirements. And ultimately what this budget reflects is how we balanced all of those decisions. So we reduced baselines, but not by a certain, by the exact amount that would offset these amounts that are going to ESCOM and a few other smaller areas. So what the net result of that is that the expenditure ceiling has been revised up somewhat, particularly in the first year, and then in the two outer years, basically we go back to very much what we had at MTBPS, because that in the outer years is where the cuts to baseline start to come through. And at the same time, we were seeing that we were again going to have revenue shortfalls. And of course, the decision there, which was a big part of the discussion on Wednesday, which is, do you raise taxes to try to offset that, or do you accept that and just put it into the budget deficit? And our view was, we can't allow too much slippage on the deficit or on debt to GDP. So we chose to raise taxes by a relatively smaller amount than we've seen in previous years, but we chose to raise taxes again. And the combination of all of those factors is what brings you to that debt to GDP graph, which shows you that our debt to GDP is now slightly higher than it was at the time of the MTBPS. But underpinning that, as you can see, is quite a lot of movement, both on the spending and the revenue side. So on that note, Chair, I'm going to hand over, because a lot of the discussions over the past 2 years have been around the credibility of the forecasts, and I think we've got quite a few points to make in that area. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. Thanks, Ian. Chair, I think as we said when we last saw you, the forecast is quite an important part of the fiscal framework, and so there have been questions asked about the performance of the forecast, the credibility, and we've got a few slides that speak to that. And I think it's just important for us to add to what Ian said earlier, to just point out that we are happy to engage with any of the committees at any point around this and sort of explain a bit more how this actually works, but I'll try and do that. I just want to make three points today. So the one point is, I want to give members a sense of what we think a good forecast is. So that'll be point number one. Point number two is, I want to just compare, using our own work and independent work, the performance of our forecast. And then point number three, I just want to talk about the current forecast and the scenarios around that forecast. So those are fundamentally the three points I'm going to try to make quite quickly. So the first point is, what do we consider to be a good forecast or a credible forecast? And in our view, it's quite important to state that we consider a credible forecast one that is balanced. So a credible forecast, a good forecast, is not optimistic and it's not too conservative. It has to be balanced. And the reason for that is because optimistic forecasts have their challenges and conservative forecasts have their challenges, and that's what the first slide speaks to. So if you have a forecast that is optimistic, as our forecast and other forecasts have been for the last few years, that raises certain challenges. It means government plans for higher spending, and to the extent that the economic growth that is implied by that optimistic forecast does not materialize, government may then need to raise taxes because revenue collection will disappoint, or it may need to raise borrowing. And we know that that has adverse consequences on growth itself. So if you increase taxes, you reduce disposable income, you reduce the incentives for firms to invest. If you increase borrowing, you increase your debt service costs, you may increase interest rates, and you crowd out other spending. So you don't want a forecast that is too optimistic, because when you have to increase borrowing and raise taxes, that actually then reduces growth. But by the same token, you also don't want a forecast that is too conservative, because if you are too conservative, it means that the government's planning for weak growth. It means that the budget office will make lower allocations to departments to spend, and it may mean that the tax team will pencil in higher taxes. So if you have lower allocations because you are being too conservative, then that means you might harm service delivery. You might harm the developmental role of the budget. And if you are too conservative and you pencil in higher taxes in response to being too conservative, that also harms economic activity, as we said previously. And also, which is a very important point, if government itself signals lower forecasts, that can actually reduce business and consumer confidence. So there is a direct channel by which people look at our forecast and say, well, this is a very conservative forecast. The Treasury is not confident in the ability of this economy to grow, and that then directly impacts business and consumer confidence. So what we think is important is to try to have a forecast that is balanced, and that's what we've tried to achieve. So let's look at our forecast relative to the forecasts of a range of other institutions. So what we have there, I wouldn't worry too much about the title, the root mean square errors. That's just a statistical technique. All that those bars represent is the size of how wrong the forecast is. If the bar is very high, the forecast is very wrong. If the bar is very close to the bottom or exactly at the bottom, if the bar is zero, that means it's a perfect forecast. So let's just look at what that slide shows us. So we've got two types of forecasts. We've compared our in-year forecast, which, for example, is the forecast that we announced in the budget 2019 for 2019. And then we've also included our year-ahead forecast, which is the forecast that we announced for 2020 in budget 2019. So if you look at that, you'll see the Treasury bars in red, and you'll see that there are forecasters that have done whose forecast error, the wrongness of their forecast, is much greater than ours, and there are some where the wrongness of their forecast is less than ours. So if you look at that, you can see in here, for example, this is forecast since 2010 to 2017. So we've taken a range of forecasts, and this is just the average performance, let's say, over that period. So you'll see there that the Reuters consensus, which is where a whole lot of financial sector economists submit their forecast to Reuters, performs slightly better than ours. Their bar is slightly lower than ours. The Media 24 consensus forecast, which is just the forecast of all of the economists that participate in the Media 24 forecasting process, is slightly better than ours. That's the light blue bar. And so too is the Bureau of Economic Research at Stellenbosch University. And you'll see that there are also other forecasts that are that performs worse than ours, which is where the error is larger, the bar is higher. And that includes the Bloomberg consensus forecast, it includes the IMF's forecast, and it includes the South African Reserve Bank's forecast from 2010 to 2017, both in year and year ahead. So this tells you that in terms of our performance, it's somewhere in the middle. We are, of course, always cognizant of the fact that we have to continue improving our forecast, and I'll talk a little bit about that later because of how important our forecast is to the fiscal framework and the budgeting process. But I think it's important to just make the point that no one gets a forecast perfectly right. Everyone gets it wrong, which is why you've got bars across the place there. Some gets it closer to reality, and some gets it very far from reality. And the Treasury performance is somewhere in the middle. Then there's been a question that's been raised about, are our forecasts too optimistic relative to them being too conservative or too pessimistic? And this makes the same point that I made on the previous slide, but slightly differently. This just shows you, again, the Treasury forecast is the red line. And essentially what this chart shows you is that for the last few years, since 2013 at least, everyone, whether it's Bloomberg, the Media 24 consensus, the Reuters consensus, the Bureau for Economic Research, the IMF, everyone's forecasts have been too optimistic. Okay? Everyone's forecast is bundled around the same area. It's all above the dashed line at the bottom. Again, the dashed line representing you getting your forecast exactly spot on, in line with the actual GDP numbers when they are released. And this just shows that everyone for the last few years, and there's a combination of reasons why that's the case. We've had various shocks to the growth numbers that most of these forecasters did not anticipate, and one of them has been Eskom and the load shedding, because of course that has a direct impact on growth. So I think it's just important for us to make that point. Just as I get to the end, I think it's important to just make the point that there have been some independent studies done of our forecast, and independent studies continue to be done, and I think we think those independent studies are very important. We do our own internal assessments of our forecast, but we also think it's important for there to be independent studies. So some of the older independent studies found that our forecasts are on par with or better than market projections, and that is sort of borne out by our own work that I showed earlier. And then I just thought I'd take one of the most recent studies, which is from towards the end of last year. It's a study by Yanni Rousseau and his colleagues at Wits University, where they compare forecasts from 2001 to 2017. And I thought I'd just put up the quote from the conclusion of their paper. And what they say there is that they've compared the forecast of the National Treasury, the South African Reserve Bank, to the consensus forecast of Media 24, and the Bureau for Economic Research at Stellenbosch University, and the result of their analysis for the growth forecast, because they compare inflation forecasts, they compare other things, but the result of the analysis for the growth forecast is inconclusive in declaring a single entity as unanimously accurate. And what they are saying is that, based on their work, they cannot say that there's one entity, be it the South African Reserve Bank, Treasury, Media 24, or the BER, that is unanimously accurate with their forecast all the time. It depends on your statistical technique for evaluating the accuracy of the forecast. It depends on the period you look at. It depends on whether you're looking at in-year forecasts or same-year forecasts. But essentially, they're saying no single institution has the best forecast over time, and I think that's also important to note. And just a point about the point we made when we were here last around the role of assumptions in the forecast, which I think is quite important as well. So, in this study, one of the points that Yanni Rousseau and his colleagues also make there is that I'll just quote from the study. They say that assumptions play a significant part in influencing a particular forecast. A recent case in point relates to one such assumption, namely global demand, which is largely based on the IMF's outlook. In recent periods, these projections for global economic growth have been repeatedly wrong, thus affecting the Treasury, the accuracy of the Treasury's forecast, and resulting in overly optimistic forecasts. And I think what's important to note here is that we do change our assumptions over time to improve our forecast. So we used to incorporate global growth into our forecast by looking at the growth of G7 economies. And then we realized over time that actually looking at the growth of G7 economies does not give us the best, the most accurate forecast, and it doesn't give us the best prediction of global growth. And then we moved to the IMF's global demand assumption, but we didn't just take their global demand assumption as is. We made sure that we weighted that global demand assumption, taking into account our 15 largest trading partners, so that we have a more accurate measure of the people that we are actually trading with. And to the extent that we find a better measure of global demand over time, then we can incorporate that measure as well. But I think what's important is that when we do, it will be transparently done and communicated, as we currently do in Chapter 2, where we communicate all of our assumptions. And then just finally, this is our current forecast that we have. So you'll see there 1.5% growth predicted for this year, going up to 1.7, and then eventually 2.1% in the outer year. But part of the reason we wanted to put up this slide is just to illustrate that in Chapter 2, you'll find that we have various scenarios around our growth forecast, and that's important to demonstrate that, yes, we provide a baseline forecast for the fiscal framework, but there are many things that could influence that, and we are very aware of those risks, both on the downside of the forecast as well as on the upside. So the bottom solid black line is what we think the implications of a sovereign downgrade by Moody's will mean for the growth outlook, what that will mean for interest rates in the economy, for the exchange rates, and how that then feeds through into our growth forecast. So there is a big downside risk to our forecast. That's the solid black line. The dashed black line is what we think is the impact on growth of an extended period of load shedding. So we have an assumption around the electricity availability factor of ESCOMs, and then we feed that through our model, and then we say if that electricity availability factor remains low and constrained for a long time, this is the implication for growth. But importantly, it's also important for us to signal the potential upside potential. And here we are saying that if the structural reforms and other matters that we've been talking about in our budget for a long time, if those do bear fruit, and that's the blue line on top, then we could actually have much higher growth rates. And that's just to signal to the market and to the ordinary citizens that to the extent that we deliver on some of the matters that we've outlined previously that constrain growth, we could actually have much higher growth. And so we are aware of some of the scenarios around our baseline forecast, but of course we need a baseline forecast for the purposes of the budget, which we then revisit a few times a year, and which, as I said earlier, we'd be happy to take the committee through in a bit more detail and to update you as our methodology and processes are refined.
Okay, thank you. Chair, we're now going to move to the specific tax matters that came up. A lot of questions around the progressivity of our tax mix, whether it's supportive of economic growth or not. Yes.
There's a miss on my part. The DG phoned me yesterday and spent quite some time explaining to me why he will not be here. And if people want to talk to me offline, because I don't think one wants to raise it here, I'm quite happy to. But he has a very legitimate reason for not being here. In fact, he was over-justifying it, right? And I told him, no, look, you know what? Your reasons are perfectly reasonable. And I will speak to Mr. Lees. I forgot to phone you this morning because I thought it might get raised. But the norm is for the DG to be here. Yeah, but actually, it's a very legitimate reason. Okay, and but the fact that he was so effusive in his apology, and he's sincere, he's not playing me or, you know, saying the things he thinks a chair would want to hear. It's genuine, it's coming from his heart. And we wish him well, by the way.
Good morning, honourable members. There are quite a few questions on tax. I'll try and go through the revenue side first and then onto the specific tax measures. I think there was a few calls for clarity on the VAT refund story. We've tried to be transparent, but we had a box in the NQBPS where we explained the position. We've had two paragraphs in the budget review trying to explain it. I'll try and give a bit more detail. I'm happy to answer further questions if they're needed. But from discussions with SARS, we found out there was this rather large backlog of VAT refunds. In the NCBPS, we revised up the amount of VAT refund they would pay. There was an agreement between SARS and Treasury that SARS would pay out a lot to try and reduce this backlog this year. We fully recognized that this would have an impact on tax revenues, but we thought it was in the best interest of the taxpayer. The minister was quite vocal in his statements in Parliament last week, or 2 weeks ago, that, you know, this is money that's going back to the taxpayers, and it shows that people are trusting SARS more if they can get these payments out. And they have been making a lot more payments. Since then, we've revised up the amount of VAT refunds that SARS are expected to pay from 220 billion to 228 billion. So that's an 8 billion increase. So the 15.4 billion deterioration in the revenue estimates since the NQBPS, 8 billion of that is a revision upwards in the VAT refunds that they are expected to pay. Now, how much of this is once-off? At the beginning of the year, SARS had a VAT credit book, which is how much SARS owes taxpayers in VAT refunds, of 30 billion. By September, this had increased to 42 billion. So there was a big increase in the beginning of the year. And they really, since that NQBPS announcement, have done a lot of effort to try and reduce that credit book. In the budget review, we said they had got it down to 31 billion by the end of Jan. And by the middle of February, they mentioned to us that it got below 25 billion. In the NQBPS, we said that the level it should be at is around 19 billion if they pay out back refunds as and if they are due. It's still going to be 19 billion because as people make submissions to get a VAT refund, SARS need to check it. They need to get the documentation in order. So there's always going to be an amount, which is usually about a monthly amount. After discussions with them, we've revised up what we think it should be if they pay everything out to 22 billion. It looks as if more taxpayers are making claims to SARS for VAT refunds, which is actually a good thing because it shows that they now believe that they will actually get a refund back, which will then help their cash flow position. But then also there are potentially higher level of potential fraud cases. So it's a balancing act. We don't want SARS just to pay everything out because then there might be more fraud. So we've revised it up to 22 billion. So the difference between the 30 billion credit book at the beginning of the year and the 22 billion at the end of the year, or what we're trying to target for, is 8 billion, and that in effect is the one-off. So what does this do to our buoyancy measures? There have been quite a few people and commentators saying, well, your buoyancy of 1.31 next year is too high. Why is this buoyancy so low? Why is it below 1? If we only looked at that VAT refund issue and we took out the one-off payment of 8 billion, so if we just excluded the one-off payment of 8 billion, the tax buoyancy in 2018-19 would be 1.08 instead of 0.98, and the next year would be 1.06 before tax measures. So you can immediately see how this one-off payment has, you know, shifted the tax buoyancies around, but if you take it out, it looks a lot more reasonable. So because of the VAT refund, it's actually 0.98 and 1.15 before tax policy measures. Now, you know, commentators are also saying, well, 1.31 is too high. Look at, you know, what it should be. But we have to, because we've increased taxes by 15 billion, you have to add that on to the amount of tax that you get, which increases your buoyancy. And that is the point of trying to raise taxes, that you get more out of the economy. And just adding that 15 billion gets us to the 1.31. So I hope that gives you a breakdown of how we go from that 0.98 to that 1.31. Part of it's VAT, the one-off 8 billion in the VAT refund payment, and part of it is the additional tax measures of 15 billion. If we go to the next slide, this is, so again, we've had commentators, as Duncan has had on his side, about the credibility of his forecast. We also have credibility, commentators have questioned the credibility of our revenue forecast. So the table you will see there on that slide, table C.C4, which we published in the MCBPS, is incredibly transparent. So that gives every line item of the major tax revenue numbers. And it says what the tax base assumption is for that line item. And then it says what the relationship is between that base and the actual revenues we collect, which is called the buoyancy. Now, it is incredibly transparent. Any analyst and investor and rating agency that we talk to, they understand exactly how we're getting to our numbers because we publish all the numbers and all our assumptions. So, you know, we think that heightened level of transparency helps our credibility because everybody can see what we're doing. I mean, to be honest, there's no way that we can fudge the numbers because they would see it immediately in the tables that we publish. So we can't. It's very open. The next question is, well, what about, you know, is it believable? Are these numbers realistic? And then it comes down to the assumptions of how do we think this tax base will change compared to economic growth. Now, there's two questions here. The one is on the economic growth credibility forecast. If growth is lower than it should be, then the tax base will be lower and we will get lower tax revenues. So that's, and Duncan's trying to deal with that side. The other question is, well, how should tax revenues change with the given growth? And that's why we have these buoyancy estimates that we publish. Now, we've had 4 years of large revenue shortfalls. I think it's 7 billion shortfall, 11 billion, 30 billion, 49 billion, now 42.8 billion. And we've been revising down our estimates of how tax revenues should change with changes in the tax basis or changes in growth. So for personal income taxes, the buoyancy used to be 1.3. So for a 10% increase in the wage bill, we'd get a 13% increase in personal income taxes. We've revised that down to 1.1. For domestic VAT at the MTBPS, we revised it down from 1.1 down to 1. And what does that mean? That means that for a 10% increase in consumption, we will get a 10% increase in domestic value-added tax. It's very simple. And those are all there, and they're not outrageous. It's in line with the IMF recommendations of what your buoyancies should be. The personal income tax buoyancy should always be above one because you have a progressive schedule. We assume that the brackets and the rebates increase by CPI inflation, but wage inflation is actually slightly higher than CPI inflation. So people will move up, just because they are getting real increases in their earnings, they will move up the progressive schedule and they'll face a slightly higher effective tax rate, and so you should have a buoyancy that's slightly above one. So we think we're being very reasonable in these assumptions. And investors, rating agencies, others, they can see it and they can go into these numbers. The other question is, you know, some commentators said, no, we're being too optimistic about SARS improvements. I just want to point out that this assumes no improvement in SARS. If you have a particular level of avoidance and evasion in the system, let's just take VAT, for example. If there is then a 10% increase in consumption, if you assume the same level of avoidance and evasion, you'll get a 10% increase in VAT. And that's what we're assuming. So we're not including any improvements for SARS yet. So we're not making any unrealistic assumptions there. So we have had those comments that it's not credible, it's not reasonable. We get a different feeling when we chat to investors. You know, some of them even say we're being slightly pessimistic because we're not including any of these. But given the very large shortfalls over the past few years, you know, we felt we needed to lower some of these buoyancies and be a bit more prudent about what the numbers would be in the future. Okay, on the next slide is on the progressivity of the personal income tax changes. So we've got a table there in the budget which tries to provide an indication of the progressivity of the personal income tax system and the change in the personal income tax rates. Now, if you don't provide any bracket creep relief year after year after year, and you keep the system the same, it will become more regressive. But these changes from year to year are very marginal. And we just want to highlight that the changes we've made over the past 4 or 5 years in the personal income tax system are highly progressive. We have made the system a lot more progressive over the last 4 or 5 years. We had a 1 percentage point increase in the 2014-15 across all the brackets. It doesn't have it in the bullet point there, excluding the bottom bracket. So the bottom bracket didn't change, but all the other rates above changed, which made it more progressive. There was the new top rate of 45% from 1 March 2017 for incomes above $1.5 million. The movement from the medical tax deduction to the medical tax credit is also highly progressive. Limiting the tax deduction for retirement fund contributions is highly progressive. Increasing the effective capital gains tax rate from 10 to 18%. And the OECD, I mean, they've published a paper that says tax design for inclusive growth. And a lot of what their proposals are what we have been trying to do. So you limit deductions for higher earners, and you try and expand the base to make it more progressive. We've also had other measures to try and improve the progressivity, increasing ad valorem excise duty on luxury products, higher estate duty of 25% on assets worth more than $30 million, which was the Davis Tax Committee report. But also we did have the VAT increase last year, and I won't get into the regressive points on that. There's also one point I want to note from the table on the personal income tax schedule, that we estimate there will be about 280,000 taxpayers next year with taxable income more than $1 million, and they will pay 40% of all personal income taxes. So we do have a highly progressive system at the moment, and we've made it more progressive overall over the past few years. And the next point is on the tax to GDP ratio. We presented this the last few years, and there is one concerning element that has happened in some of the commentators that have made the put forward the chart here, and has been in the media. And they keep referring to the World Bank data that says South Africa is the 9th highest taxed country in the world. And I've said this over a number of years, that is misleading. And personally, I think it's irresponsible. Tax is a very sensitive subject, and these media articles and these commentators saying that we are the 9th highest taxed, you know, country in the world makes people very agitated. It increases the level of discontent, but it's misleading. And it's very easy to see why it's misleading, because that World Bank data explicitly states this excludes social security contributions, and state or provincial taxes. So because South Africa has very low social security contributions, which in my view is a good thing because payroll taxes are regressive and they are a wedge for employment. So if you have high unemployment, you don't want high payroll taxes. And also because we have the majority of our revenues coming from to central government, not going to provinces, on that list, on that World Bank list, we ranked highly on that list. But it's not an accurate way of looking at the tax-to-GDP ratio. A more appropriate measure is the OECD measure, which includes these social security contributions. And I must just add, social security contributions in other countries are not, some of them are not ring-fenced. So it's exactly the same as having a tax that then goes into a national revenue fund that you can determine where it goes. So it's not ring-fenced benefits. But the OECD has a much better view. And, you know, on the World Bank list, we are seen to be taxed more than Sweden, taxed more than Austria, taxed more than the UK and all these other developed countries. And if you look at the OECD list, that is different. We're around, it's actually slightly lower than that, 26%, and these other countries are much, much higher. And it's a much more appropriate way of looking at it. Okay, the other point that we got was, and we had it last year, and we've put the slide forward again just on why we haven't increased the corporate income tax. You know, we had long discussions about this last year. Just, I mean, quickly on the points, the headline CIT rate, i.e. the top rate that you see of 28%, really is one of the fundamental drivers of investment decisions from international investors. You know, we're in a process, the president has put forward an investment summit, there's this investment drive. You know, international investors would look at that headline rate as the first thing that they look at. We have a rate of 28%, which hasn't changed in a decade, and all the other countries are reducing their rates. So the UK is now at 19%. It's going to be the US has gone down to 21%. Mauritius is at 15%. And the bigger the differential between your headline rate and other countries, your trading partners, the bigger the incentive to shift profits abroad. So if you have a high headline rate but your trading partners have a low rate, you can have a multinational between the two, and they will try as hard as they can to shift their profits from South Africa to those lower tax countries and get it taxed at a lower rate offshore. And it increases that risk. And also, just to note, 40% of CIT revenue is generated by subsidiaries of foreign multinational enterprises. So we've implemented a lot of proposals to try and counter BEPS. We are part of the OECD inclusive framework, G20 OECD inclusive framework, and we are an active part of that, and we are getting high quality legislation in to try and combat this, but we need the skills within the revenue authority to be able to implement these legislative changes. And also, just to note, 2 years ago we increased the dividends withholding tax from 15% to 20%, and if you are a capital owner, how do you get revenue out of a corporate if you're a capital owner? You get it through dividends, or you get it through capital gains tax. And we've increased capital gains tax from 10 to 18%, and we've increased the dividends tax rate from 15 to 20%. So those owners of capital, those who are residents, will be paying more on the returns they get from their capital. And we must also just note, we are very wary about the incidence of tax increases. So you might have a corporate income tax increase, but you've got to be careful about where the incidence lies. Does it lie on employees, and there have been studies where employees then have lower wages and there's lower employment, or does it lie on consumers, eventually through higher prices? So it won't all fall on the corporates, but there's a debate within the economics profession about what the proportion of that incidence is, but it certainly doesn't all lie with the corporate. So and we've gone through those points before. Just on the last, there were a few other points, the carbon tax implementation date. And we published a box in the budget review. There are a couple of regulations that we need to get gazetted and finalized before the implementation. But, of course, you can't gazette regulations until the actual bill is passed. So we have consulted on those, and we will continue to consult until, you know, or if the bill is passed. I'm not putting any pressure on Parliament. And then we will publish them when they are available. The fuel levy, there was a question on the impact of the fuel levy on paraffin, it's compressed natural gas, liquefied natural gas, and biofuels. So we just stated that we are doing a review. we noticed that there are a lot more vehicles on the road that are using these other types of propulsion technologies, but they aren't included in our current road tax net. So, for example, the Road Accident Fund levy, it's not charged on vehicles that use compressed natural gas. But if they haven't, if someone has an accident with a vehicle with compressed natural gas, they will be covered by the Road Accident Fund. So there's this anomaly there that we need to think about and fix. And there are also other reasons for the road, I mean, for the general fuel levy, in terms of congestion, in terms of the impact on the environment, and those need to be taken into account as well. At the moment, there isn't a system, and that is just why we are reviewing it. I think we've provided clarity on the battery fund. There was a question on, you know, automatically indexing the HPL levy to inflation. In all our other measures and tax, we don't automatically index. We do have a clause in the carbon tax bill that says we will automatically index that rate, but it's not done in the rest of the income tax literature. So we do have the discretion, and we try and provide the discretion to the minister each year to see whether it should increase by inflation or an amount above or below inflation. And that is the policy at the moment. The retrospective amendments, I think, was to do with the dividend share stripping. This is, and it might be, it might cause a lot of tension amongst industry, but for closing loopholes, you need to try and announce from the date of the announcement. You can't tell the country there's a loophole and we will close it in 6 months' time. Everyone will do the loophole. So, you know, it is quite contentious because it's an immediate change, but this is not out of line with other countries who do the same thing. So if it is a tax avoidance structure, and in this case, you know, it's about share issuance through a convoluted structure with dividends being paid out, loans, and then a share issuance, which is, in our view, certainly just to avoid tax. And there isn't a, you know, an actual business reason for it. And I'm not a SARS official, so this can't be taken as the view of SARS. I'm just a policy person. But that is a reason for why it needs to, some of these announcements need to be done on the date. And the wealth tax, we are still discussing this. There are a lot of reports from the Davis Tax Committee that we are going through very, very carefully. Their proposal on the wealth tax was to make sure that every individual includes all their information on wealth in their returns. We are considering it very carefully, and we will, if we will make an announcement, it will be through the budget review or through the minister. Thanks.
Okay. Thanks, Chair. So I'm just going to round off now. There were a few very specific expenditure issues that came up, and I'll touch on them briefly. They are discussed in the budget review. I think one of the questions was around the likely impact of early retirement without penalties on service delivery. Just to say on that point that how this is being proposed is by no means a free-for-all. It's going to be a carefully managed process between the DPSA, the Treasury, and, of course, the line departments that are implementing this. The circular is very clear. It's saying that, effectively, the accounting officer of every department must make a call. This must be done in a reasoned way, looking at the requirements of the department, the kind of savings that are going to be achieved, and so on. So I just want to make that clear. It's not as though anyone who applies will receive it. It has to be done in a careful and structured way between the members of the department and the accounting officer of each. The financial support for ESCOM, some questions around that. What is it for? Fundamentally, this is about making sure that ESCOM doesn't default, because we hold a lot of guaranteed debt of ESCOM, and of course ESCOM remains by far the largest state-owned company. So this is funding set aside to ensure that they can cover their debt service costs or a share of their debt service costs and their capital repayments over the next 3 years. And of course, exactly how that money flows will depend on the final operational and financial structure of the new entity and the subsidiaries, and where the assets and liabilities of those different entities sit. So there's a lot of work underway, but the fundamental is that this is to ensure that they can cover their debt service repayments and capital repayments. Then lastly, there were two specific issues, one on a proposal to double the December old age grant and the other on subsidization of insurance premiums for emerging markets. Just to say on that, these are effectively budget bids, and of course They can be considered, but they will have to go through the formal processes. So, for example, in the case of the old age grant, the department that is responsible for making policy and putting in budget bids around old age grants will be the Department of Social Development. So the way this process should go is that the department should be approached and there should be a decision made as to whether or not this should go into the budget process, and therefore be decided as part of the MTEC discussions. And of course there are lots of competing pressures on the budget currently, and the decision wants to be taken as to which of these new spending proposals ultimately appear in the MTBPS. And that brings us to the end of, I see we've just gone over 1 hour, but thank you very much for this opportunity.
This was a very important reply back session. Thank you for that. Thank you for taking an hour. All the members, on Wednesday we invited our stakeholders to be present today to come and listen, but also to do a follow-up question. I only see Kosato here. I don't see anyone else here. But welcome to the PBO. On page, what's this page number? On page 15 of the budget review, you look at the economic growth in countries in the world. But you capture Sub-Saharan Africa just in one line. I read a report this morning. Ghana is growing at will be growing at 6.8% this year. SAA is connecting with the airline in Ghana to grow the market in terms of passengers traveling on SAA and then en route to Washington and the United States to get more revenue. If you can look, and also to the PBO, the countries we trade with in Africa, how do they look like, their economic growth? How can we benefit from that? Inter-trade, etc. I just want to make that point. The last remark you made about the retirement issue, because the teachers are up in arms. There's a shortage of teachers in South Africa. That's the reality. There's a bigger outflow than there's an inflow because of the age difference. So I just want to make that point as well. Kosato, Matthew, Comrade Matthew, is there anything you want to ask them? We're giving you the first opportunity as stakeholder. 5 minutes.
Okay, thanks very much, Comrade Chair. Just a few comments from our side. I think maybe to say, as Kosato, we do sympathize with the difficult spot that government is in. I think the economic crisis, the fiscal crisis, the crisis of corruption, etc., it's unprecedented. So we do sympathize government doesn't have a magic wand. It's a very difficult spot. But I think, Chair, we were a bit underwhelmed by the budget. We didn't see much of a plan to take us out of this crisis. We do feel that the President is doing fantastic work trying to clean up the state, but we felt the government could be much more bold on quite a few issues. Otherwise, we feel we're just treading water. We're barely escaping the economic recession. Workers are losing their jobs left, right, and center. And our workers are being threatened with retrenchments both in the private and the public sector. I think, Chair, maybe our kind of key issues, not to give Treasury a shopping list, we had very good progressive presidential jobs and investment summits in October last year, with clear plans both for the private sector, the public sector, to move the economy forward, which is the heart of the issues. But the minister in his speech made a two-sentence response. There's no clear plan from government how is it going to implement its share of the deals, and also how to assist the private sector to also move the economy forward. And if we don't move the economy forward, we're just treading water here. And in fact, Chair, we've seen, even though the President committed to no retrenchments in the summit, we now see the state running in the opposite direction, threatening workers from SAA, SABC, ESCOM, etc. Chair, I think on the VAT issue, we appreciate the sanitary pads and the flour, but I don't feel that's a sufficient cushioning of the poor to withstand the aggressive nature of the VAT and other tax hikes. We were pleased in the ANC manifesto there's a commitment to increasing the free water, free electricity allocation for indigent households. We really hope to see more from Treasury speaking to that, how to cushion the poor. Chair, if you look at the AG's reports around wasteful expenditure corruption, Charles, about 10% of the budget. That alone is 10 times the VAT hike. If you could just reduce that to have a clear plan from government how to recover that money, expand the role of the chief procurement officer to waste, to reduce wasteful expenditure, a lot of these issues could have been dealt with instead of us chasing workers into the unemployment queue. Chair, on the carbon and sugar tax, you know, the Finance Committee gave good space for labor, for government business to engage in NEDLAC. We had some job agreements, but again, there's not much of a plan of action from government to implement those commitments. So we're increasing the taxes on the poor, industry fine, but no equal plan of action. Though we must say, Chair, we do appreciate the allocation for insurance premium assistance to emerging farmers, which was part of the sugar tax agreement. Chair, on the wage bill, we actually take a different stance than the Minister of Finance that it's out of control. If we look at the budget itself, it's largely stable at 35%, which is in line with international norms. But our plea there, Chair, is simply for government to engage labor at the Public Service Bargaining Council. We can come with ideas how to reduce wasteful expenditure within it, or what are the things can be about including the SOEs under the Public Service Bargaining Council agreements. Because that's really where you see at a management level the wage bill exploding, where you have SOE CEOs earning 8 million rand, etc. But again, Chair, I think there are challenges for government to engage. We would want to really see, lastly, Chair, clear plans around how to save and stabilize the SOEs. There is some engagement around ESCOM, but not much around the other SOEs. More worrying, Chair, was that there was barely a mention around the basic collapse of Metro Rail. This is something we've been raising for years and is having a heavy impact upon the economy, etc. In fact, we saw a reduction in expenditure by PRASA, yet Metro Rail is basically in the ICU. Last two issues, Chair, I think on the debt levels, we really want to see a more convincing plan from government to stabilize the debt and start reducing it. I think we're very worried that we're hitting the 60%, and we're not convinced we're not going to go beyond that, and that'll hurt workers. Then lastly, Chair, if I can smuggle in something, we would really want to hear the Minister of Finance support the PIC bill in his budget speech, to welcome it as a key tool against corruption in the PIC. And instead, we haven't seen that. We think that is really a missed opportunity from Treasury to join the Finance Committee in supporting that bill, Chair. Thanks very much.
Thank you to Kusatu. You captured what Mr. Pop said. Honourable members, over to you, and I'm going to start with Honourable Tobias because I cut this short on Wednesday. So I'm starting with you. Okay. Gave the opportunity, yeah. Honourable Elise, anyone else? Honourable Monakedi had also a question on Wednesday to the Treasury. And then we said they're going to reply today. Do you just want to recapture it?
No,
they responded.
Yeah,
fine?
That's on the issue of forecast.
Okay. Honourable Issa, did you raise your hand? Yes. All right, we start with Honourable Lees and then to you. Thank you. Anyone else? None? Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It is quite warm in here, and I think that Matthew is embarrassed by his blue shirt, so he's keeping his jacket on there. So, but strangely enough... a lot of what Matthew has just said, we would agree with. Some we would obviously not agree with, but certainly there's some progressivity, as some people seem to define progressivity. Humor aside, Mr. Chair, thank you. In terms, Duncan, of the pessimistic and the optimistic, you say rightly so that in the last few years, we've been overly optimistic. We all accept that. And yet, we're still tending to go into the new period optimistic. What's happened over our optimistic years is expenditure has been determined by the optimistic forecasts, And so our debt levels just keep going higher and higher and higher. Surely the time has come to take a pessimistic view to some extent. We're not talking austerity. This word austerity really doesn't fit into this picture at all. I think the words of optimistic, even pessimistic, is probably not the right word. But surely we should be being more robust about reducing expenditure, because it's gone up far more than it should have done, given that we took optimistic views. So it's not like we're being austere. It's simply correcting errors in the past years. Forget about who was right, who was wrong, which forecast. The fact is that we got it wrong. Would you agree that we should really be looking at it a bit more robustly at expenditure and to try and pull the debt levels up? That's basically my question and my view, actually, so never mind. The early retirement, I'm not sure who would answer this, but I'm getting queries about when are the window going to open? And I asked that at the post-budget briefing and didn't get an answer. Have you guys got any idea when this window is going to open? Because the people are looking at escaping for some reason. Then the other issue with regard to that, I think, has partly been brought up, but Ian, I think it was you who said this is going to be managed, and the minister himself said this is going to be managed. But you can't have this kind of thing which is not of general application. You can't discriminate and say, well, actually, you can't have it, but you can have it. Just because you happen to be a teacher and you happen to be a mechanic in the Defence Force. On what basis are we going to discriminate between civil servants who cannot take it? Simply on the basis of what we determine, or the whoever makes the determination about skills that we need. I suggest that's going to be very, very problematic in terms of the application, but perhaps I don't know enough about labour law in this regard. An agreement with Matthew. I mean, we put the sugar tax, whatever you want to call it, HBL, in place, and we were going to take some steps to mitigate. Now we're seeing the consequences. We're seeing potential 350,000 job losses in the sugar industry. And it's just going to happen. I'm surprised Matthew's not shouting more about it. And we don't see any steps being taken to either reduce the tax, we're actually increasing the tax, or put some other measures in place to compensate for it. And I know it's not a Treasury issue, really, but you have increased the tax. So on what basis are you doing that, given the real job losses that are now facing? With regard to Eskom, this huge non-electrified elephant in the room, the $23 billion, is that enough to cover the debt burden in interest and redemptions? And if the tariff increase, what does that do to the required tariff increase? What is your assumption about the tariff increase? They're looking at 56 or 57% over the next 3 years. With this $69 billion, what does that bring that tariff down to? Presumably you looked into that in your calculations. In terms of the contingency reserve, again, I think it was you who talked about that. I'm just a bit foggy, most of the time a bit foggy, but about how one accesses this money. It's not being allocated to a bailout for SABC, which I see the minister has now said is coming, confirmed in the media 2 days ago. How do we access it? It's not a budget line item that can now be paid out in contingency reserve. Surely there must be some sort of parliamentary role now in actually using the contingency reserve. is it just the minister can say, right, we're going to pay it for this or that or whatever. Perhaps I should have done my homework, but it's easier to just ask you the question, how you access it. Mr. Chairman, Chris, you kind of indicate that the bracket creep adjustments would have been just marginal. Maybe I misread you, but actually 12.8 billion rand is a lot of money, and it's going to have a huge impact on taxpayers, and is a very real tax increase for personal income taxpayers. But I think perhaps I was not quite following you. I mean, you were quite right. In previous years, we posed it, have pushed the made it very much more progressive, and this year it's gone the other way, the opposite way, as it were. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Honourable Lees, Honourable Isaac.
Yeah, thank you, Chairperson. Lots have been said already between Alf and Matthew, but I just wanted to allude to following through and some comparisons of the slides. If you look at slide 5, and I think Alf alluded to this one also, in terms of the forecast and what has been happening globally, as you outlined in your presentation, are we honestly being realistic? Because year on year, it wouldn't be fair to use the word mislead, but at what point and when do we really become realistic and say, listen, ratings agencies, yes, understandable, but this is the realistic scenario. Because year on year, we get a forecast, and I think most of us realize that the forecast is is not that realistic and achievable. But I think Alf alluded to that. And then I just wanted to quickly touch on slide 6 and couple it with slide 7. The minister alluded to in his budget speech that, we're borrowing some 1.2 billion rand a day. I think Honorable De Beer summed it up the other day when he said that's excluding weekends. So it's a worrying in that, with this kind of borrowings, and where the expenditure ceiling is going to, how do we contend with stabilizing this with a declining revenue base, and this is why I'm asking and saying that at what point in time do we begin to get realistic, or do we continue appeasing or thinking about what the ratings agencies are going to say to us? I can understand that. But we have to really, at some point in time, become realistic and honest with ourselves. And then the last one I've raised, because I think Alf covered most of what I wanted to say and about the pensions and the taxes. Finally, Chairperson, if you look at slide 8, you talk on, the largest SOEs have debt redemptions of around 40 billion in 2019-20 and then going up to 55 billion in 2021. And then in the last bullet you say, after capital investment and debt servicing, most institutions now show negative cash flows. Would you confirm that really some of these SOEs are really in a state of bankruptcy? And then why are you as National Treasury, if that be the case, not recommending strongly that some of these SOEs be privatized? Chairperson, thanks.
Thank you, Honourable Members. And to Kusatu. Honourable Members, on Wednesday a matter was raised by one of the members referring to the team from Pietermaritzburg Pensioners Forum. And the impression was created that this committee made promises when they appeared before us in October, November, in the public hearings. I take members back to the 27th of November, ETC, page 196, 10.4. I'm going to read it to you, but it must be put on record. Moreover, in view of the low economic growth rate and the other very difficult economic circumstances, it would not be possible to do this. They wanted an increase. Or the increase the pension to a living wage of 8,000 rand. However, here it comes, the committee recommends that in view of the VAT increases, the VAT increases, constant increases in the cost of fuel and increases in the cost of living generally, National Treasury consider a higher increase in grants than is usually the case by reprioritizing expenditure and not exacerbating the debt to GDP ratio, as increases in debt in these specific circumstances will ultimately affect the poor disproportionately the most. I want to put this on record because this is what the committee said. We didn't create impression of yes, going to do this and that because of the dire straits we are in terms of the national fiscus. So I just wanted to do that. Yes, please, co-chair.
You know, it wasn't just that it was said. It was the way it was said, the tone in which it was said. And what in the English language is that, I don't know, Kev, whether I want to say tendentious, you know, putting something in to serve a narrow cause in a very crude way. So I would suggest that we write to the member, he's your committee member, is that right?
Yeah.
Write to him and just tell him, here's the record. We made no promises. Can you imagine this committee, even if it's our buddies in COSATU coming here, telling us double the pension in December in those conditions, we're going to say, how? Okay, fine, we'll do it. And then we'll say, if you don't do it, we won't take part in the elections. And so we'll say, well, all right, tough then. That's what I think the ANC will say. We'll even pander to that, okay?
Yeah.
So we could never have done that. And I just think that amendment needs to be sorted out, frankly. And I urge that you, maybe we should jointly, since the joint, we both write to him, but he's your member, you should really, and just correct that. Thank you.
Again, meet jointly on Tuesday, the 5th of March, when we consider the fiscal framework report. We can deal with it at that time. The other one that we have to do follow-ups on, honourable members, is we have summits. There were resolutions. There were outcomes. Now, what happened?
Yes.
Because the summits were called to stimulate economic growth. It's now 4 months, 4.5. So we want to hear that report. I don't know if it's still possible before the NA adjourns the 20th, but there must be something. If you can send us something. We don't have a formal meeting, but let me just get some feedback. The other one on expenditure to save, and I'm saying it again, video conferencing in provinces. There are meetings that officials must attend, like Lagotlas, etc. But there are other meetings that they can do via video conferencing, Skype, etc. We did it as a doc committee dealing with Northwest. It worked 100%. 100% we did all the work in the committee. PBO was present as well. I'm going to stop there. Over to you for your response.
A few quick things. The first is the cushioning of the effect of the VAT. That is our existing position, right? Now, in this meeting, we begin to advise the two committee chairs and the staff that are here, what it is that we want to put in our recommendations. So I hope that Antonia and Esther and all are listening. And Esther seems to be very distracted, but I hope she's listening. These are the recommendations, because it's not fair. It's not the committee staff's responsibility to write the recommendations. They're not politicians. They can give us some of their views, but hey, that's the first instance, the task of the two chairs, and then we will let others look at the draft by Monday morning as we do and vote on it. This is the last time, Mr. Lees, we will ever process the bill so fast, the budget so fast. It's over now. Over. We've changed the Money Bills Act. Now, what I want to say is, can members also, when they make the input, suggest what the recommendations are, so the staff might put it down in bullet point notes, right, and then we will write it up in political idioms. So, firstly, on the VAT cushion, are we agreed, we still committed to that, we know there are budgetary constraints, but that was the deal we struck on the VAT bill, right? Anybody disagree with that? Right, so we're going to put that in the report, colleagues who are doing the draft. Secondly, you see, one of the problems is that while Treasury's responsibility, it's not Treasury's responsibility alone to shape any economic recovery, economic growth, investment, job creation plan, and it can't be set out in a budget, the elements of it are there, there's not enough here, even if you put the threads together, of where we are going in terms of the overall economy, unless we get growth, investment, jobs. So we need to say to you that you need to do some work on linking the budget with the president's economic recovery and stimulus plan, which is hardly mentioned here. So what happened to that? Right. Can you answer? You may say these are the budgetary aspects of effecting that plan, but it's not clear to us how. So what happened to that economic recovery and stimulus plan that you know, we're speaking to with the medium-term budget policy statement? There's a lacuna here. Thirdly, you see, we can't have this endless summit and there are no consequences. So I think, comrades, colleagues, you have put that in a report. What's happened about a job summit? And recommend to the sixth parliament that this committee, the Economic Development Committee, the Trade and Industry Committee, the Labour Committee, all meet and look within the first 3 months. We cannot prescribe to them, right? We can recommend. And I will put it like this, those who might want to help with the first draft. The committee recommends the incoming committees in and potential to consider having. Our committee has already taken a decision last week, we should now make it a formal one in this report, that the bills that we have passed related to processes in NEDLAC, those bills, the sugar beverages tax, the carbon tax bill, every quarter NEDLAC must be brought here. Ideally, with the committee that deals with NEDLAC, right? If they don't come, it's fine. We can meet with NEDLAC and say, on this particular bill, we agreed that this will be the jobs plan. How far has the jobs plan gone? How many jobs have been saved? How have people been re-engineered to continue to work, either in the sugar sector in this case or elsewhere? The same would apply to the carbon tax bill. Now, a figure is being flung around of 100,000 jobs lost or something else, 1,000 jobs lost. Interestingly, in an exchange with Daily Maverick yesterday, about which I have to report to this committee, it was then to have been raised in the House about the behavior of the African Climate Reality Project, an NGO, how unethical they've been, and I'm reporting to you because it's my job to do so. But before I write to correct these things, after negotiations of 10 days that have got nowhere, I need to brief you on why that matter has to be corrected. But I will ask for 5 minutes at the end. But let me come back to this. We look at the carbon tax bill. We try to strike deals between, not deals, a compromise, a balance, a set of balances between the needs and interests of COSATU and its labor force and workers who are concerned about job losses, big business who say, hey, we don't want this thing, and of course the NGOs who say, we want it all, you are sellouts, you know. So we find balances and then we phase things in. As I understand it, the majority in the committee wanted a higher carbon tax rate, but then business would be up in arms and COSATU would be up in arms. So the point is, comrades, We have to go to NEDLAC and demand. They come every quarter. Otherwise, there's no credibility. It's like we're selling people out. We're telling them, okay, go to NEDLAC, strike a deal. Once you come back, Mr. Vilakazi reports to us, and we say, okay, now we're going to vote on the bill. Well, it's our job to follow up on whether NEDLAC implemented those provisions. Now, Daily Maverick told me yesterday that they are doing a check on those figures. They don't buy them. So COSATU will say, the figures are worse than that. The newspapers or investigative journalists are saying they don't buy it. The NGOs will say it's nonsense. So I spoke to all of them yesterday. So let's see whether it's 1,000 jobs. But you know what? Even if it's 500 jobs, we need to ask all these departments to come also. Economic development, agriculture, national treasury, you guys. Where, Alex, you in particular, right? You are treasury. Remember? So your boss is not here. You're a nice guy. You see, your boss, he's not such a nice guy, so we treat him tough. We don't treat you tough. But we are saying to you, Alex, it's on your conscience. We agree to that bulk sugar beverages tax on the understanding that job losses will be minimal.
Yes.
COSATU agrees that obesity is wrong and health wrong. It affects workers mainly. But they have to balance that out against losses. Similarly on carbon tax, I'm sure your climate change resolutions are all progressive, but you could. So while we don't like pander and mollycoddle COSATU, and we tell them to jump in the lake when we have to, never mind how close we are to them. The truth of the matter is we gave them commitments, and we cannot behave like irresponsible politicians, really. So I'm pleading that we put in a provision there about quarterly reports.
Thank you, Comrade Karim. Treasury, you may reply, starting with COSATU and then the other two members. And Co-Chair Karim's input. Thank you.
Okay. So a lot of different topics here. So let me try and cover some of the headline fiscal issues. Okay. So the first question is, should we be reducing expenditure more? I think that was kind of one of the fundamental questions that has been put to us. And this relates both to aggregate spending and I think also to the compensation bill. Because, I mean, yes, as COSATU is saying, it's been pretty stable at around 35% of total consolidated expenditure, but the issue is that it has grown very substantially, the wage bill now specifically, over the past decade. So in the past, the wage bill was pretty consistently around 32% of consolidated expenditure, and that rose pretty consistently, and then it's come down a little bit and stabilized at around 35, and with the proposals that we have in these numbers, it'll come down a little bit further. Now, I mean, we've said for a while that this is not a simple issue. We know this is very complex, and we, by no means are we suggesting that there's some simple answer to the wage bill pressure that we have. But our numbers are also fairly clear that the civil servants in national provincial departments on average are earning 40% more in inflation-adjusted terms than they were a decade ago or so. And that is really the big story. And in that sense, COSATU's comments on the headcount and so on are correct, and the comments from the chair as well on the headcount is correct. The real pressure on the wage bill is really about paying civil servants a lot more in inflation-adjusted terms than they would have received in the past, and we've tried to put that down several times. And yes, this is an imperfect way of managing the headcount. Managing the wage bill is to bring down headcount over time. But if we want to, there are only two levers available. One is headcount, the other is actual wages. If you want to reduce pressure on expenditure, and you want to do that by reducing the wage bill, you can either bring down headcounts or you must make a decision to actually reduce the pay of civil servants, which is obviously a discussion that will have to happen, a political discussion that will have to happen. Now, can we bring down spending more? And this is the balance that Treasury has tried to strike for the past 6 years, because if you look at what has effectively happened since the introduction of the expenditure ceiling in 2012 is that, first of all, spending growth fell off sharply when we introduced the ceiling, but it has continued to grow in real terms. However, because of our downward revisions to growth and the increases in debt, we've pretty much consistently revised down that expenditure ceiling until the current budget. And the reductions in the beginning were falling almost exclusively on goods and services, and then more recently they've fallen also on capital. And we, you know, we've been saying for a while we don't think that's the way forward. You don't want to be reducing capital budgets over a long period of time, because that'll harm investment and growth, and that of course has implications for the sustainability of the fiscus. So what we have in this budget is an attempt to take some pressure off budgets through interventions on the wage bill side, as imperfect as they may be. And to answer your question about, you know, what needs to be done if you want to reduce spending more, well, the answer is you have to make decisions on closing of programs rather than what we've had in the past, which are across-the-board reductions. And again, you know, the theory will tell you across-the-board reductions can be done for a while, but they end up being quite harmful because you're not actually making choices about which areas should be cut. You're just saying, here's a headline cut, we're putting it across all departments and they must manage within that reduction. And that is also not a good long-term strategy. So we've been saying this for a while. Decisions are required around what our priorities are, and if we really are serious about reducing expenditure much more, it would have to be about closing specific programs rather than continuing with across-the-board reductions.
So, sorry, Ian, can you speak into the mic?
Oh, excuse me.
The staff must capture what you are saying.
Right. Yeah. Okay. So, and okay. So, let me just quickly have a look at the list. Okay. So, I think the question, you know, how does this actually play out? When is it introduced? The early retirement. Work is underway. We're anticipating that DPSA should release the formal circular at any time, basically. The question about what, how this plays out and you know, the specifics of who can and can't take this up, I mean, you may be right, but our understanding of the discussions with the DPSA is that this is ultimately up to the accounting officer of each department, and they have to manage as best they can within the requirements of the department. And we're going to have to see how that plays out from there. The ESCOM story, look, the fundamental issue is that there's a lot of uncertainty about how much support ESCOM requires. And the number we have in the budget is a best estimate based on discussions with, for example, the presidential task team around what kind of balance sheet support is required by ESCOM. So ESCOM spoke a lot towards the end of last year about requiring proposing a debt takeover equivalent to $100 billion of their debt. You know, having discussed with the task team in detail and with ESCOM and others, we are estimating, the best estimate we have currently is that the balance sheet support is about $150 billion that they require, and we've chosen to amortize that over 10 years, which is the $23 billion now. That, of course, you know, the question is, can it be done differently? The answer is yes, and we need to look into all of the different options available. But fundamentally, we wanted something that was fiscally transparent and that was linked to the requirements, ESCOM's requirements. And over time, we're going to have to look at exactly how much is required beyond the medium term. But it seems clear to us that ESCOM is going to need significant support over the short to medium term. And maybe to your question as well, it effectively is equivalent to about two-thirds of their debt service repayments over the next 3 years. But I reiterate, there is great uncertainty around the ESCOM number, and it's dependent on the tariff estimates. For example, the tariff estimates we're using currently are in the book. It's about 10% per annum over the next 3 years. Those might be different. If you really want to go into a long discussion, we know that as the tariffs go up, demand for electricity will come down. So it's a very complex issue, and it's going to be a long-term reform, and you know, work is underway as we speak on these operational and financial reforms. Contingency reserve, there are a variety of ways it can be accessed. I mean, the one is to put out a special appropriation bill for consideration by cabinet that, for example, includes sale of non-core assets in it and the amounts and for which SOCs. The other is that it simply goes into the MTEC processes in October, in which case, you know, the exact allocations would be announced in the MTBPS and then flow sometime early next year only. And then there are other options for
funding that is announced in the speech. The specifics I'm not going to go into now, but the Minister of Finance, if he announces in the speech through the appropriation bill, can allocate funding through that he had not yet, no. And the reason is because there are conditions attached. One is that there should be sale of non-core assets equivalent to the amount of funding for the smaller SOCs. And the second is that DPE is in the process, has committed to accelerating the reform process of these smaller entities and has spoken explicitly also of, for example, strategic equity partners. So in a sense, what we've done is that we know there's going to be pressure coming from these smaller entities. We've put some funding aside, but the specifics of how it's going to flow is going to depend on the conditions and the reform process underpinning it. I've covered quite a lot. Can I perhaps hand over to my colleagues, and if I think of something else that I've missed, I will come back to it. Please proceed.
Thank you, Chair. There were just a few questions for me to respond to. Just to start with the first one, around the countries we trade with in Africa and what their growth rate is and how we can share in that growth. We do talk about that a little bit in Chapter 2 of the budget review, and I think there are a few important points worth making there. The one is that the one challenge with growth in sub-Saharan Africa has been that the largest economies in sub-Saharan Africa, South Africa, Nigeria, and Angola, the three largest economies, have been the slowest growing economies in sub-Saharan Africa, so that weighs on the entire region's growth. But what you have seen is that some of the smaller economies, Kenya, Rwanda, and so on, have all been growing at sort of plus 4%. And so the question is, how do we share in some of that, and what types of industries in South Africa are best positioned to take advantage of some of that growth? And where we've seen is there have been some very interesting trends recently. The one has been that clearly there are few sectors in which that growth has been beneficial for us. The one has been our manufacturing sector, and I think we need to think about how to leverage that. The EU used to be our largest foreign market for our manufacturing exports. That's no longer the case. It hasn't been the case for the last two or three years. That market is now sub-Saharan Africa. So most of our manufactured export products now go into sub-Saharan Africa. We've also seen the number of tourists arriving from sub-Saharan Africa growing quite substantially, and obviously tourism is a critical services export because we earn dollars, we earn foreign currency from it, and obviously it has a whole range of other benefits in terms of its employment multipliers, in terms of how spatially diverse it is, in terms of its impact on the economy and so on. And then a big driver, and I think this is also where we need to think about how we position ourselves to benefit from the growth in the region, has been our services sector and services exports into the region, whether that's financial services, construction, etc. And I think a big part of what we'll have to think about going forward, and there's quite a lot of work that's been done inside the Treasury and outside, is how do we deal with some of the binding constraints to access some of these markets, and a lot of them relate to infrastructure, for example, and opening up the region from an infrastructure point of view, from a border point of view, and so on. And I think there are also quite a lot of regional value chains that I think when we establish them, whether they are in transport and logistics, whether they are in biofuels, whether they are in construction, that I think could have benefits. And we will gladly share with the committees some of the work that we've done in that area. And so I'll make sure that we follow up in terms of quite a lot of good work has been done in that area, and we'll gladly share the studies that we've done in collaboration with the University of Johannesburg and others on that. There was a question from Kosatu about can we be more bold on the growth agenda, because we all acknowledge that growth is key. I mean, one of the points that we make in the book is that we say on page 12 of chapter 2, we say, of the budget review, we say raising the economic growth rate requires a range of short-term interventions and longer-term reforms. And then we add this additional element, which is along with improved capacity to implement these reforms. And then we do talk a little bit about what we think some of those changes are. We talk about the importance of export-led growth. We talk to the importance of the inclusivity of that growth, the role of tourism and agriculture in that inclusivity, and the fact that, especially in agriculture, there are a range of export-intensive, labor-intensive commodities where we have massive comparative advantages relative to the rest of the world. We are the leading exporters of some of the major export and labor-intensive commodities, macadamias, table grapes, avocados, and so on. And I think there's a lot there that we can leverage, and I think as government and with the relevant departments, I think there's certainly work underway to think about how we continue to boost that. But between pages 13 and 14, we do talk quite a bit about what we think the kind of bold structural reforms are, including the role of public education, the role of integrated spatial planning, urban densification, and so on. But I won't go into the details here. All those details are captured in the book. There was a question about shouldn't we be more conservative, but I think that was on the expenditure side. Shouldn't we be more conservative on the expenditure as opposed to on our growth forecast, because I do think we've made the point on growth. There was also a question about, you know, what is realistic in terms of what to expect in terms of our growth numbers. And I think it is important to point out that we are, again, we are focusing on trying to be as accurate as possible from a growth forecast perspective. And what is important also to point out is that if you look at, for example, our current forecast, which we have revised downwards relative to the MTBPS, the outer year of that forecast is lower than most other institutions. So the Bureau of Economic Research says in the outer year we're going to grow at 2.4%. The Reserve Bank thinks we're going to grow at 2.2%. The Reuters economists think we're going to grow at 2.2%, and we've put in 2.1 in our outer year. So we are trying over time to become more realistic, more accurate, based on the latest available information that feeds into our forecast. And I think that's critical to point out as well. And then just finally, two questions on the link between the budget and the economic recovery plan. We do have on page 12 of the budget review, we do provide an update on the President's economic stimulus and recovery plan. We do talk about specifically what's happened as far as the growth-enhancing reforms contained in that plan are concerned on page 12 in the box. We were very involved with the presidency and others in crafting the plan and discussing the plan in government. Of course, the execution of the plan relies on those relevant line departments. So when you're talking about spectrum, visa amendments, mining policy, administered prices, procurement, which is where we play a role because of the procurement bill, and measures to safeguard industry around the chicken industry, the sugar industry, and so on, we do provide an update on page 12 of what the progress has been since the announcement of the economic recovery and stimulus plan up until the time of the budget. So for example, we talk about what's happening on the mining policy certainty and the developments there. We talk about what's been happening on administered prices and so on. The detail is there because we do think that the growth-enhancing reforms contained in that plan are quite critical to get us to higher levels of growth. And then on the summits and the various summits that we've had, what's been the progress? I think it is absolutely, I think, imperative both for the committee and for ourselves in government to continuously get feedback on the commitments and progress against the commitments. Of course, you had various departments that were involved. Treasury played a role in the job summit, and so did the Department of Labor, the Department of Planning, Monitoring and Evaluation, DTI, and others, and similar on the investor conference where the Department of EDD took the lead there. And I do think what will be useful is just to get a sense of where we are. The one thing the President has announced in the SONA, which I think is important, is the formalization of what was called the issues log, and saying that the Treasury and DPE and the Presidency are going to lead a process to
have regular updates on the issues log, and the issues log is essentially what the investment envoys and the job summit and other summits have identified as the constraints on growth and how to alleviate them. And so the strategy is to say regularly within government, with reports to cabinet, we need to be following up on the commitments in the job summit, in the investment summit, more formally, and that has to go directly to cabinet so that they can follow up where needs be. Because without the kind of regular accountability and reporting mechanism, it's going to be very difficult for us to achieve the targets that we've set out in those summits.
Nick?
I think there was just one question, Honorable Lees, on the racket creep and the impact. I wasn't meaning to say that the impact of bracket creep is marginal. We completely understand that this will put pressure on households. If you have an inflationary increase in your wage, an inflationary increase in the cost of living, but now, in effect, we are taking more tax because we haven't increased the brackets, that will put pressure on households, and we're not trying to say it won't. We are, you know, some people have called this a stealth tax, but we are very open in our Chapter 4 that this raises revenue, that this is a new tax. And we're not trying to hide it at all. We're not trying to shy away from that. I think I was trying to say that the impact on the change in progressivity is marginal compared to the bigger changes we've had in the previous years. And there are quite a few other points on the HPL and the carbon tax, but I assume those are recommendations from the committee to Treasury, which we will abide by. Thanks.
You done?
Perhaps, Chair, just to add one more the comment on the ratings agencies and whether this is sufficient. I mean, we have been in discussions with the ratings agencies, and of course there has been a slippage on the headline fiscal numbers, which has been noted and of course is a credit negative. But in general, my sense is that it's all going to depend on the implementation of this reform plan around ESCOM. And if this is done credibly, transparently, and we move rapidly on this reform, then in a sense we will have been confronting and addressing the major fiscal challenge, both to the economy and the public finances. So our sense is if the plan is credible and we can move on it, then we should be able to maintain our credit rating.
Thank you. The engagement between the finance committees, well, maybe the other committees in the economic cluster, the executive, regarding outcomes of summits, growing the economy, is crucial. That meeting must be diarized. The reality is new members are coming back to Parliament, there's an induction period, etc. Maybe a short break, I don't know. So we're talking about August, September, when we will engage of the sixth Parliament with the appropriation bill, where every department comes and puts its plan on the table. That engagement is a very important one, because that's the plan for that department for the financial year. And then quarterly meetings to see what progress is being made to measure. So there's a lot of work waiting for the new members in the sixth Parliament. I don't think they know what's waiting for them. The other reality is, honorable members, if you look at our committee report on the proposed fiscal framework, 27 November, 80 seat, those matters raised there is still relevant. It's still relevant. So I'm just registering that with you. Honorable Karim said you want to come in at the end. You're welcome. And then you can do the wrap up.
Oh, what have we done?
Well, it looks like it is.
Oh, if we finish then, does it matter that... Please,
it's addressed to the Standing Committee on Finance, but because you're processing carbon tax bill and you're having public hearings, on your side you might have to address this issue. I need some time, comrades, because I could do this and go ahead, but I really want to communicate to you why I have to do this. Look, very quickly, in a nutshell, since chairing the first meeting in 1998, the committees that I've been in, we have what Tony Ngeni described as rolling public hearings. There's no such rule for it.
In other words, we have public hearings till the day we... Anybody can make submissions on a bill till the day we vote on it. Within reasonable limits. And we allow stakeholders to sit in at meetings, and every now and then they participate. Let's not cover the ground before. This disproportionately benefits the well-connected structures, big business mainly, but also the big trade unions and big NGOs. Now, when it came to the carbon tax bill, what we did is what we always do, and what I've always been doing as a chair. What you do is, if they are contesting stakeholders at issue, and it's very complex, you ask Treasury to go and meet, in our case now, in Pretoria, and get a consensus, come back here. Where you don't get a consensus, we decide what we're going to do. Secondly, whatever you agree on, we may still reject it, because you don't decide. Then thirdly, as a chair, within the mandates here, and I don't always seek mandates, because it's obvious to me what we're trying to do. So you will engage with COSATU privately and say, hey, guys, we know you want jobs lost, but your own policy says you're opposed to climate change. So come strike a deal. We got a business, I speak to them over the phone, sometimes they ring me, I say to them, no. You know what we can consider is bringing the tax down slightly, but we have to get the consensus of the NGOs and, you know. So on the sugar beverages tax, I haven't got the time. I spent endless hours over the phone, beside what you do, between the NGOs, African emerging farmers, established farmers, big business, trade unions and so on. Matthew is easy because we see him a lot. And say, okay, it's a give and take approach. So the understanding and the norm is that whatever I say in these meetings is not meant to go into the public domain. Because how does a chair or anybody negotiate between respective stakeholders, okay, if they're going to leak it in the public domain? So in that context, the African Climate Reality Project made yet another submission. Alan drew it to my attention that we did not specifically look at that submission, nor was there a requirement for it. Because we already had informal public hearings, as we do with all money bills, in an informal way. When it comes to the formal process, we do not ever have public hearings unless something dramatically new emerges. So he then referred the letter to me. Now, I don't know if any other committee chair would do this. On the day that we were coming here, I found a lady called Noel Cassett. And I said to her, listen, my friend, since you're persisting, we'll put the issue on the agenda for today. Although we're voting on the bill, the first item will be your issues. I have sent it to Treasury. I've sent it to the staff, I think Zakela and them. I've sent it to other people for them to look at. And I phoned Momo and said to Yanga, both of them, you have to reply to it. No other committee chair does that, nor is there an obligation. In that fast exchange with her, rushing to Parliament, in a 10-minute or so exchange with her, at some stage or the other, I might have said, I cannot recall, something like this. You cannot only be concerned about the environment, you have to take into account investment, growth, jobs, something like that. So she puts a crude presentation, completely out of context. And when I found her to say, because several of you SMS'd me and WhatsApp'd me and said, hey, did you really say that? I told her I never said that in that sense. What I was trying to communicate to you was it's a set of balances. We are not saying that the economy trumps climate change. We are saying both are important. The one must reinforce the other. That you need to find the right balances. That you have to get in a phased approach. If you don't get a small tax in now, through the door, you'll never get it for another few years, by the time the new parliament convenes. And I'm saying this because it's very important. NGOs should not abuse members of parliament here. And it's my integrity personally that's at issue. And I have a right to defend my integrity. I don't need the consent, but I want to raise issues that we have to confer with the next parliament, whoever they are, that these things have to be managed. There was no obligation on me to phone her. So she puts into an article where she says basically we sold out, basically we have no political courage, which is fine, it's a right to say it. But then she quotes me tendentiously and in a crude way, out of context. So as I understand it, colleagues, whether we voted or didn't vote on the bill, what we sought to do was take into account the needs and interests of COSATU and other trade unions, who who support the struggle against climate change, but they were concerned about their jobs. That's why we put it in an end-life process. That was the one set of issues. The NGOs, few as they were, they never came in large numbers, unlike the sugar beverages tax. And as poor as the quality of the engagement with us was, compared to the brilliant interventions on the sugar beverages tax, we engaged with them. I repeatedly said, why are the NGOs not here? I asked Alan, can you ring the NGOs, Alan? And he tried ringing them and so on. There wasn't much cooperation because maybe they got no resources. And we also then engaged with business. I also spoke to business and said to them, hey guys, there's no way we will postpone this bill. You can go to the court and do what you want. And as I began to get a grasp of the bill, and then guided by Tandi, in fact, Tandi knows that bill far better than me, and convinced by Tandi and listening to her carefully, I said, hey, the bill is correct. Let's start something. You either get a small tax or nothing. Right. No, that's not anything to do. Now, I have phoned that lady, and I told her, firstly, it is unethical for you to quote what is part of a negotiated, mediated process of talking to stakeholders in a give-and-take approach. She apologized for that. Then I said, I didn't say it like that. It was not an interview with you. It was not rigorous and carefully thought through as I seek to do in meetings or I seek to do in reports. I might have said something vaguely like, that's not what I say. We're not counterposing climate change and economic growth. Of course we all care about climate change. I myself am an environmentalist, a strong environmentalist. I myself strongly believe we should have had a higher tax, but listening to everybody to find the right balances. So, she agreed to it, she apologized. I asked one of our comrades to deal with it, and in future, well, there's no future, I will take responsibility for responding at the end, because you ask comrades to do it, and they agree, and then they don't. It's not fair. Then whose name gets impugned? Mine. So in future, I will intervene myself and reply. So I'm making it clear to you, I will be writing to the Daily Maverick on shortly. I have engaged, I'm going to engage with the chair of the board. No. No, that's not what the agreement was between us, but let's not get involved. That's not relevant. Now, that's not relevant. Tandi, we talk about, it's not true. I had given the explanation, and what was given is a small summary. And that's not correct. You sacrifice a member's integrity. That's not correct. I would never do it to another member. So let me tell you this. No, Tandi, we can have a meeting
on Saturday. If you're not happy with my response, why don't you address me privately?
No, I have addressed you with an SMS, yes. So what I'm saying to you is, what was done was inadequate. I cannot have this situation. I will be writing to them. I'm writing to the chair of the board to make it clear that what was done was wrong. That's not the way you engage. No, you can never have negotiations then. It's never been done since 1998 where an NGO has behaved like that, or anybody, even the private sector. So I'm very clear, and we can have that discussion outside. So I'm saying in short, I will be doing it. I'm informing you. If anybody wants to say anything on that matter, you are free to do so now. There are rules and norms. I've spoken to Frank Jenkins. He says it's unethical. You don't do that. Thank you very much. Anybody wants to comment, they must deal directly with it now.
Thank you, Honorable Karim. Anyone to comment on what Honorable Karim said? None? Honorable members, I think we came to the end of this engagement. Our next round will be Tuesday, the 5th of March, when the two committees meet jointly again to look and consider the report on the fiscal framework and revenue proposals. So there's a busy weekend ahead of us after we step through that door to start doing and compiling the first draft of the report. And after we've adjourned, close the meeting, the staff must just stay behind, that myself and Honorable Karim and Honorable Tandi just meet with them. I thank you for your presentations. Anything you want to add?
Can I read something that we always ask in the chair?
Yes.
Do members want to advise us now, because we have such limited time, on what proposals they feel we should put in the report? So it doesn't seem like the chairs have suddenly sprung things on them. Now, as I understand it, colleagues, there are some things that should go in based on our previous discussion. On the Nugent Commission, shouldn't we say broadly that we welcome it? because it will be the only way we put it on paper. Remember, we're out now. We don't know what the sixth committee will decide, sixth parliament's committee will decide. So shouldn't we say we broadly welcome the Nugent Commission report, that the committee up till now, and take an excerpt from our previous reports on what we think should be done about SARS, given our considerable experience about SARS. And then we don't take decisions for the sixth committee. We say they should consider the option of an inspector general or a board or both. Secondly, I think we should also say, repeat the things we said already.
Yep.
The other thing I'd like to say too is that we had a lot of experience of the Makwakwa matter, and it's there more than anywhere else that we realize that there's a fundamentally wrong happening here, though we couldn't pin it down, we had no evidence. On the VAT returns, we also began to understand that things are wrong, but again, we couldn't prove it. And look, we should not be narrowly party political, really. The first thing to say is that, you know what, the truth is on the Makwakwa matter, we knew very little. It was a DA that raised it, and we all sort of were bemused and, you know, like, we didn't understand what was going on. And secondly, on the VAT returns, again, it's a DA that first raised it, and we were not aware of it at that stage. One of the things the committee might want to reflect on our exit report, and it's important, we must be honest, really. I think this committee, and it's not about me, it's the collective committee, which has been a very good committee in my view. I think we made mistakes. We made mistakes, and we should acknowledge them. I think we must take some measure of responsibility for the increasing, let's say, decline of SARS. We heard a lot in the corridors, and people would reach out to you, but nobody came to the committee because they're vulnerable. Some of them are people within SARS. They can't come here and say things. You picked it up in the corridors. Tandy, I'm sure, picked up a lot. I picked up a lot. We in our respective roles in... Okay, but I picked up these things, but we couldn't prove them. We couldn't prove them. So, and people, when they lie, this is another thing we must put in our exit report. I'm saying this because these things are linked to something. When people lie, you can't prove it. How do you prove they lie? You can't say a person is lying. But I think ultimately, because we're looking at the exit report next week, I think we should admit to some extent we were not rigorous and effective enough when it came to SARS. We might also want to ask whether we performed well on the PIC. We must ask ourselves that. That was very hard to do, but whether we performed well on it. We've sort of rescued ourselves, if you like, by the bill we've passed in the House. But I think as a committee, we should be open to our weaknesses. But I'm leaving members to think about it, because next week we have to vote on our exit report. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Member Green. This meeting is closed. Thank you for your attendance. Thank you for travel.